I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. The story that Diane Downs told on the night of May 19th, 1983, never varied much in the years to come. Now, there'd be a detail or two that she would change, but she would blame that on meds, fatigue, dreams, or other people's misunderstandings. But one key thing never changed. Every time she spoke of the sequence of events that took place on a dark, rural Oregon road that late spring evening, she always gave herself first billing in the starring role of victim. And she would talk and talk and talk and talk. One detective called it verbal vomit about what happened while remaining unemotional and, behaviorally speaking, a bit peculiar, even a little self-amused, smiling at the wrong times. That would arouse suspicion about her story almost from the get-go. The cops saw it, the doctors and nurses saw it, and soon enough, when her family called a press conference to tell her side of what happened, almost everyone else saw it too. She was a woman who had, she said, been approached by a stranger when she stopped her car in unfamiliar surroundings. That man, he had bushy hair but no discernible accent, had, for no clear reason, proceeded to shoot her and her three children. One child died almost instantly. The other two would be grievously injured while their brave mother sustained a single gunshot wound to her left forearm. She had struggled with a man, she said. He had wanted her car, but she pretended to throw the keys into the woods, thus ensuring her own ability to get back into the car and drive away. Straight away, the story seemed hinky enough to deserve attention. Her subsequent behavior, well, that ensured it. Officials all agreed the behavior was either the most unusual response to shock they had ever witnessed, or the unbroken ramblings of a sociopath and a narcissist who had just tried to kill her children. It would soon be clear which was true. As investigators pressed deeper, they found that nearly every important detail in Diane's account either conflicted with the evidence or contradicted itself. By the time the case reached court, the question was no longer whether the story was wrong, but why she had told it in the first place. This is Diane talking to local Eugene reporter Ann Bradley of KEZI-TV not long after. An upbeat but solicitous Diane was taking mild offense that her word and her concern for her children was already being doubted by police.
Everybody says you sure were lucky. Well, I don't feel very lucky. I couldn't tie my damn shoes for about 2 months. It is very painful. It is still painful. I have a steel plate on my arm. I will for a year and a half. The The scar is going to be there forever. I'm going to remember that night for the rest of my life, whether I want to or not. I don't think I was very lucky. I think my kids were lucky. If I had been shot the way they were, we all would have died.
Notice she doesn't mention the child who did in fact die. Now, 8-year-old Christy had been shot twice in the chest. 3-year-old Danny was shot in the back and left paralyzed from the waist down. And 7-year-old Cheryl had been shot twice, with one bullet piercing her heart. She had choked on her own blood as she lay dying in the front passenger seat floor of her mother's new red Nissan Pulsar. So yeah, the kids were lucky. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Quince. Okay, real talk to start this ad. The sheets currently on our bed are not Quince sheets because we got behind on laundry, and I hate these.
She really does. They pop off the corners of the mattress in the middle of the night, which feels personal.
It is personal, and it's exactly why I'm obsessed with Quince bedding. Once you sleep on their linen sheets, everything else just feels wrong. They're soft, breathable, and they actually stay put.
Quince uses 100% European flax for their linen, so you get that relaxed, lived-in feel without it feeling flimsy. And somehow they just keep getting better the more you wash them.
And it's not just sheets. Their duvets, quilts, pillows, and shams are made from premium fabrics like organic cotton, bamboo, and silk. It's one of those upgrades that makes your whole bedroom feel calmer and more put together.
What really surprised me is the price. Quince bedding costs about half of what similar brands charge because they cut out the middleman and work directly with top artisans.
They're so soft and cozy that my morning alarm has become more of a suggestion than a rule.
So if your bed could use a reset,
or if your sheets are actively fighting you at night,
treat yourself to bedding that's built to last with Quince. Go to quince.com/centuries for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns.
Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/centuries. Free shipping and 365-day returns.
quince.com/centuries.
When surgeon Stephen Wilhite was paged to return to the Springfield, Oregon hospital where the children had been brought, he sorted his thoughts about how he was going to handle what he'd been told were gunshot wounds to 3 children. Finding that Cheryl had already succumbed to her wounds, he looked at Christy and feared the worst. He told ABC News,
"When I looked at Christy, I thought she was dead. Her pupils were dilated. Her blood pressure was non-existent. And she is so close to death, it's unbelievable."
The staff at Mackenzie Willamette Medical Center was working on both Christy and her brother, and after Wilhite was able to revive Christy and partially stabilize her, he went to speak to their mother. Former Detective Doug Welch remembered being appalled by her response.
"Her demeanor was flat, not one tear, even though she knew that Cheryl had died."
Then she said, "Boy, this has really spoiled my vacation."
And then she says, "That really ruined my new car. I got blood all over the back of it."
When Wilhite brought the subject back to Christy, Diane told him she knew that the child was brain dead and gave him permission to pull the plug. He protested that the little girl was not brain dead and he was not about to abandon her. Wilhite would later say he knew immediately, given their conversation and Diane's own less-than-spectacular wound, that she had shot her children. So sure of it was he that, after initial measures had been made to save the children's lives, he found a judge who issued an immediate order to place the surviving children under his care. That was necessary, he would explain, so that medical staff could ignore her directives and manage the children's care as they saw fit. In coming days, Wilhite also took note that whenever Diane visited, the little girl's vitals would spike so much that Diane often had to be removed from her presence. Other staff members who attended to Christy told the doctor they had noticed it too. Christy, who had not only suffered the gunshot wounds but a stroke during the ordeal, was clearly scared of her mother. And Maybe Diane was scared of Christy too, or more specifically, scared of what Christy might say. For now, though, Christy wasn't saying anything. The stroke she had suffered had impaired her ability to speak. Her story would have to wait. In the meantime, authorities only knew the obvious. The children had been shot. What they didn't know was what had happened on that road and who had pulled the trigger. There are two versions of the tragedy. The first, Diane told on that morning after, when her two remaining children's lives hung in the balance. As an effort to nail down her story, law enforcement took her and her father, who had arrived quickly at the hospital, out to the scene. As Downs told it, she and the children were out for a sightseeing ride. It was something the family liked to do, she said. They were cruising the outskirts of Springfield, preferring to take the back roads, as they tended to be quite scenic, she said. But this sightseeing ride was around 10 at night. It was dark. On the car's sound system, they were listening to their favorite tape, Duran Duran's Rio. Diane was driving on Old Mohawk Road. All the children fell asleep. According to a Washington Post reporter who drove the same route while reporting on the crime, there were thick woods on one side of the road and an overgrown field on the other. That's where Diane took a small bend in the road, where she said she saw a stranger flagging her down. Here's Diane talking to a whole bevy of reporters the day after the attack.
We were just out, I guess, sightseeing, I guess you'd say. And the kids got tired. They fell asleep in the car. So I decided to just head on home. But I saw a road I hadn't been on before. We like to take back roads. And just went down that road. And there was a guy standing in the road, flagging me down. So I stopped.
Diane said she had gotten out of her car to see if she might help the bushy-haired man. Maybe he was hurt or his car was having trouble. That's when he demanded she give him the car. She said something like, "You must be kidding." She then pretended to throw her keys into the woods to distract him. Not buying her ruse, he stuck his gun in the car and began to shoot all three sleeping children inside. She said she could barely think of what to do, but managed to struggle with the man over his .22 caliber pistol. That had resulted in her being shot in the left arm. She then bravely, she said, shoved him aside and got back into the car and sped away. The police had a different theory. They suspected that Diane had taken her children to a remote location to shoot them. There had been no stranger, no gun tussle. But why? She had no insurance on them. If she wanted to be rid of them for some reason, there were other options. It didn't make sense. If it was dark, how had the stranger known there were children in the car? What would his motive have been? And why would a woman alone with her kids stop to help someone in the dark, someone she described as looking rough, having a stubbly beard and wearing a dirty white t-shirt? Both Diane and the police went to work immediately to put forward the narrative that would either put Diane in prison or paint her as a tragic figure, a mother who had the misfortune to meet a lunatic in the middle of the night, done nothing to deserve his wrath and bullets, not to mention all that scorn, derision, and the loss of her children. Diane found the media pretty fast, calling a press conference the day after the shootings.
I am here just to appeal for people out there, to, if they know anything, to call in.
Dan was quite the photogenic survivor. The slight 27-year-old blonde had a rather long face and big eyes. Some say they saw a resemblance to Princess Diana. She was also a single mother who had just lost a child and who, while behaving strangely, knew she could evoke considerable sympathy and attention by being in front of this thing. She made herself available to law enforcement as well. 3 days after the shootings, she agreed to be videotaped reenacting the sequence of events that night. As Lane County Detective Doug Welch said, they just wanted to nail down her statements. She was more than happy to do that. This is the voice of Downs on a police-made video.
I'm throwing the keys, okay? I'm throwing the keys. I go like that. I got in the car, jumped in, put the keys in. I just hit my cast!
You hear that laughing? Well, in the video, you see Downs getting into the Nissan and hitting her left arm, now in a cast, against the steering wheel. She seemed amused by that. Then she said,
"This is worse than okay.
This is worse than okay." She didn't finish that sentence, but the cops took note of it. They also made a point to watch every one of her TV interviews to see if her story changed. Reporter Ann Bradley nabbed a one-on-one interview with Diane. Bradley later explained that Diane had been told she could bring her lawyer with her, but that she showed up to the studio alone. This seemed a good chance for Diane to again make her case to the public.
This is an Eyewitness News special report. In her own words, Elizabeth Diane Downs.
Good evening.
The two women, Bradley was also young, blonde, and pretty, made for must-see TV. Bradley was eminently professional. Diane was Diane.
When this man shot my daughter, my first reaction was to snap back to my childhood, to the pain that had happened to me back then, my marriage, my entrapment by society. This man was bigger than me. He was stronger than me. He had more power because he had a gun. And I stood there and I looked at Christy reaching, and the blood that just kept gushing out of her mouth. What do you do?
It was in that interview that she remarked how very lucky her children were that she hadn't been killed that night. And the more she talked, the more police dug in. They needed evidence. They combed the car for it. They found that there was no blood in the immediate vicinity of the driver's seat. Interesting. They combed the woods for the gun. No luck. They tried to find the bushy-haired man or anyone who had also seen him on the road that night. They did find a man, named in the documents as Mr. Wilson, who lived in the woods near where Diane said she had been stopped. Wilson said there was a man down the road a piece who fit the description, but when the cops found that man, they discovered he had a rather severe speech impediment, and in all of Diane's remarks about the bushy-haired man, she had never mentioned that detail, which would have stood out. In fact, per police transcripts, she was explicitly asked if there was any defining characteristic of the man, a tattoo, an accent perhaps, or a stutter, and she had said no. Police were getting nowhere, but neither was Diane. By now, a few weeks post-incident, the nation was riveted. Because this was 1983, and what Diane Downs was suspected of doing was so incredibly heinous that no one could look away. It would take another 10 years for Susan Smith to kill her two boys, and almost two decades before Andrea Yates would execute her five children. The nation was just waking up to the crime of filicide, which, while not common, exists. According to USA Today, which undertook an examination of the FBI's national records in 2014, 450 children are killed every year by their parents. Most are under the age of five. Most are killed while being beaten. Few are shot. Anyway, it's done. It's a crime so monstrous that it boggles the imagination. Here's Diane again, questioning why she would do such a thing.
If I had shot my own children, would I not have done a good job of it? Why would I have taken my kids to the hospital? Wouldn't I have made sure they were dead and then cried crocodile tears? That's insane to think that I would do such a thing and then bring the witnesses in against myself. That's crazy.
Diane almost dared the police to charge her with a crime.
Christy woke up, and as I say, she may be the only one to get me out of this. Would I have brought her to the hospital? Wouldn't she be the one that I would make sure is dead? There are too many holes in it.
9 months after she'd told Dr. Wilhite her vacation had been ruined, Diane Downs was indicted on one count of murder, two counts of attempted murder, and two counts of assault in the first degree. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Home Chef. So now that the holidays are over and winter is fully settled in, I'm in that mode where I want dinner to be warm, comforting, and require as little thinking as possible.
Same. When it's dark by dinner time, my motivation to plan a meal drops to about zero.
We were just talking about this. That's why we'll be leaning hard on Home Chef. Having fresh, pre-portioned meals show up means I'm not staring into the fridge wondering how we got here.
Home Chef really does make cooking simple. Fresh food delivered, easy recipes to follow, and meals that actually taste great. It's not complicated, and it doesn't feel like a project. They've also got dishes co-created with celebrity chefs like Gordon Ramsay, which is wild considering how approachable everything still is.
You'll find those across Home Chef's Culinary Collection, Classic Meal Kits, and Express Options. So whether you want something cozy and hands-on or just need dinner done fast, it works.
There are over 30 meal options every week, including a family menu with 4 or 6 serving dinners, which makes planning way easier.
And it actually saves money. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 a month on groceries, which, yeah, we'll take that.
For a limited time, Home Chef is offering listeners 50% off and free shipping for your first box, plus free dessert for life. Go to homechef.com/COTC.
By the time Diane Downs was indicted, the question of motive had become crystal clear. Let's roll back a few years. And one of crime author Ann Rule's most successful books, Small Sacrifices, Rule delved deeply into Diane's life and found it profoundly sad. And, because it is Diane who did the telling of it, a bit suspect. Rule acknowledged that. Here's an excerpt from the book. Quote, "All memory is flawed, weighted and skewed by individual perception. What has happened does not matter as much as what we remember. That mind mirror freezes its own images. The child in Diane Downs's memory is pathetic, a skinny, wistful little girl, ignored by her mother, tormented by her father, a waif scuffling through the sifting Arizona dust with the wrong shoes as she walks home from school alone. A child without friends," end quote. Her parents, Wes and Willa Dean Fredrickson, were the stereotypical 1950s couple. Wes worked, Willa Dean kept house and had 5 children before she was 25. Diane had been the first, but was soon pushed aside by the others who needed their mother's time. By the time Diane was 5, her mother noticed that her eldest child didn't warm to her father. But everyone obeyed Wes, who Rule characterized as a stern disciplinarian, a martinet. Later, Diane would accuse her father of repeated sexual abuse from the age of 12 on. Her mother steadfastly denied it ever happened. Her father never responded to the allegations. Diane said the abuse stopped abruptly after Wes was pulled over by an Arizona state trooper who noticed that the young teen in the car was rumpled and frightened. She said Wes had taken Diane into the desert so no one could hear her screams of protest. The trooper had asked Diane repeatedly if she was okay, but she didn't dare open her mouth. The trooper then pulled Wes out of the car and, out of earshot, spoke harshly and directly to Wes. Whatever he said worked, according to Diane, but the damage had been done. Diane thought of most men as vile and controlling, yet seemed to be hypersexualized for a lot of her life. She met Steve Downs in high school, and she told him of the abuse she had suffered. He seemed nice enough, though he too had shown signs of dominating behavior. They began a torrid relationship. And while she said she didn't care for sex, she thought of it as a way of controlling men. She had been a good student and went to a Pacific Coast Baptist Bible College for a few months. But one version of her expulsion was that she and another student were found fornicating on the church altar, thus desecrating it for all time. She came home, married Steve, who, as Rule wrote, was her ticket out of the house she lived in with her parents. Diane did not believe that Steve loved her, but she craved love and attention. The way to get it, she figured, was to have children who would shower her with both. She had, by now, secured work as a mail carrier. Steve worked too, but they made little money. The family couldn't afford much time off. She had the 2 girls in rapid succession. Records show she reported for work a day after having given birth. The couple moved in and out of the Fredrickson home. Diane wanted better, so she signed up for the Army. That was short-lived. She went back to carrying mail. Steve, whose first extramarital affair occurred only 2 weeks after their marriage, continued to date other women, proving cruel to her in as many ways as he could. She became pregnant again, but this time opted for an abortion. Steve got a vasectomy, which wasn't entirely effective. She got pregnant again. The chaos seemed unending. In late 1979, when Diane was 24, she gave birth to Danny. The botched vasectomy got fixed, and it looked like they would be the little family that could. Well, they weren't. Depressed, financially in bad shape, and in a crappy marriage, Diane would sometimes beat and braid her own children, who lived in a kind of transient state of fear. She would occasionally experience what she called blackouts. Then, in April 1980, she chanced upon a Phil Donahue episode on TV that showcased surrogate parenting. This was the job she was made for. She considered getting pregnant to be the easiest thing she had ever done. She was what they used to call a fertile myrtle, and she saw an opportunity. When asked about this later, she dismissed a suggestion made by Oprah Winfrey that she liked being pregnant. Instead, she said,
I've been pregnant 5 times. With my very first child, Christy was a baby that liked to stretch out. She separated my ribs. Every time I get pregnant, it is an excruciating experience that nobody would normally want to go through that kind of thing, knowing that it's going to be as painful as it is for at least the last 5 months. I love children. The reason that I became a surrogate was because there I saw a program in which a woman was told over and over and over by doctors that she could not have children, and I knew what it was like to be told that you can't have a child, which is why Daniel was conceived. My husband kept saying, you can't have a baby, and I did it anyway.
Diane started her journey as a surrogate when, a day after the Donahue program aired, she contacted the doctors at the Louisville, Kentucky clinic that had spoken on the show. She sounded good to them. Young, a mother already, someone who seemed ready to do something for others. She passed every physical test. Then came the psychological screenings, 10 of them. They included the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, the Wide Range Achievement Test, the Rotter Incomplete Sentences Blank, and the Rorschach Inkblot Test. She proved to be very bright, but very unstable. Per Ann Rule, the report from the clinical psychologist read, quote, these findings were consistent with, but not absolutely diagnostic of, a major psychopathology, end quote. Rule summarized the findings this way, quote, Diane apparently perceived the world around her uniquely. Her test results might have been early warnings of a profound psychosis, parentheses insanity, or only of strong personality quirks. End quote. Diane thought she had passed with flying colors. Told she would have to be reassessed, she consulted a Phoenix psychiatrist who also noted her quirks, suggesting she was histrionic and narcissistic. While she waited to be told she could be a surrogate parent and earn the $10,000 fee for doing so, she and Steve finally broke up. As a single parent, she saw no hindrance to dating regularly and was known to leave her children home alone if she couldn't find someone to sit with them. Christy was 6, Cheryl was 5, Danny was 18 months. Realizing the neglect, a neighbor called child services, but later agreed to mind the children whenever Diane was unable to. That was often. She was never without a boyfriend or lover now. She was particularly fond of sleeping with married men. He was not supposed to be screwing around. That was exciting. As she told Ann Rule in a letter, quote, I loved them all. I just don't go to bed with people. I love them. Sex hadn't been rewarding with Steve, although a relationship is not founded merely on sex. I only slept with Tim Lowry 2 times, and I only slept with Walt Neff once. The other guys were my friends, end quote. Now, despite having not passed her psychological exams, Diane was given the go-ahead to become a surrogate. She was impregnated through the miracle of science in late 1981. And she already had her eye on another coworker, a married man. His name was Robert Nick Knickerbocker, though prosecutors would call him something else. Motive. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by ButcherBox. Now, you know that moment when you open the fridge and it's just chaos, random leftovers, half a plan, zero inspiration?
Every January, the holidays are over, but the exhaustion is still very much here.
That's why ButcherBox has been such a lifesaver for us. Having high-quality proteins already stocked means dinner feels manageable again, even on busy nights.
ButcherBox delivers over 100 premium protein options straight to your door, including 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork-raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood.
And for nearly a decade, they've led the industry with meat and seafood that's antibiotic-free, hormone-free, and independently verified. It's just a more trustworthy way to stock your freezer.
What I like is that every product meets the same standards, whether it's filet mignon or chicken nuggets.
We've been able to customize our box around what we actually use, which makes meal prep and weeknight dinners way less stressful.
Plus, every box ships free, including members-only perks like recipe inspiration, tips, and exclusive deals.
As an exclusive offer, our listeners can get free steak in every box for a year plus $20 off your first box when you go to butcherbox.com/COTC.
That's right. Your choice of filet mignon, New York strip, or ribeye in every box for an entire year plus $20 off your first box and free shipping always.
That's butcherbox.com/COTC. Don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. Diane Downs met the man she would call Nick at the U.S. Post Office in Chandler, Arizona, where they both worked. It was not an instant thing. By mid-1982, Diane had slept with almost every other man in the office, and it was time to see if Nick wanted to cheat on his wife Charlotte for a bit. He had been injured on the job and had, for a brief time, been taken off his mail route and put in the office, where he was put in close proximity to Diane, who had just given birth and, a little bit reluctantly, handed the surrogate child over to its legal mother. Diane had told Nick she was eager to do it again. He said he couldn't get her pregnant, so he wouldn't be in the way. The two flirted. His own marriage was going through a rough patch. He figured Diane wasn't interested in anything serious. The flirting grew into something more. But Nick was super clear on a crucial point. He did not want to be a father, not to his own kids, and certainly not to anyone else's. This is what most single mothers would consider deal-breaker material, but not Diane. Instead, Diane was all in, not just on Nick, but on everything. She set about to fix her life. She decided she wanted to be a doctor, so she went back to school, taking day classes twice a week and night classes on alternate days. She gave the kids to Steve and kept her full-time job. But she became unhappy when she realized she had too little time for Nick. By now, Nick was ready for this fling to be over. He told his wife everything. She'd been very forgiving. These things happen. Diane didn't take the rejection well. She had a physical fight with Steve where she threatened suicide, then used her .22-caliber Ruger semi-automatic pistol to shoot a hole in her trailer floor. She hounded Nick for a second chance. He folded like he was holding a bad poker hand. Life was looking up. She went to Kentucky for a third insemination, the second hadn't taken, and came home pregnant. She attended Christie's 8th birthday party. That same night, her trailer caught fire. It was an electrical glitch. Insulation had melted. Arson investigators looked, but didn't find cause for further investigation. Later, Nick would tell Oregon investigators that Diane had told him she had paid Steve to set it on fire. So now she was living in a half-burned trailer, writing daily in her diary about how much she loved Nick, weaving elaborate tales about how they could reconcile her family with his desire to not be a father to anyone's children. They moved in together while he decided which way he wanted his life to go. Diane began a crusade to convince him she was the way it should go. She bombarded Nick with poetry and letters and cards, even giving him things she said the kids made for him, most of it gushed with teenaged ardor. A way to solve a few problems, she then imagined, was to move back to Oregon. She was truly homesick and thought that Nick would follow her and Charlotte, his wife, would be 1,200 miles away from them. She applied for a transfer to the Eugene Post Office. She told him to do the same. Her father, incidentally, was the postmaster in Eugene, and when her parents met Nick, Wes offered each of them their choice of jobs. By then, though, Nick was done. Author Anne Rule.
Diane was thinking that her married lover in the post office in Chandler, Arizona, would follow her. And when I interviewed him, he said, Anne, I was just so glad when I realized she'd crossed the county line headed out of here that I never considered following her. But she was desperate to get his attention.
Oprah and Diane discussed that very thing.
I want you to tell me, were you obsessed with Nick?
No, I don't think I've ever been obsessed with a man in my life. There are too many men in the world, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. So you were not, okay, were you not?
I had many lovers. I had many lovers at that time.
Were you madly in love with him?
I loved him. I've never been madly in love with anybody.
Okay. Did you think that he was going to come and be with you? Were you trying to convince him to be with you and leave his wife? You were not.
Diane's diaries and letters, when read by police and prosecutors, would tell a vastly different story. The man who had been in charge of Diane's case almost from the very first day was Lane County Deputy District Attorney Fred Hughey. He and his investigators spent months trying to unravel her story. In that pursuit, they had tracked down and read all of the letters Diane and Nick had exchanged and all of Diane's diary entries that focused on her pursuit of him. The truth about the relationship soon became clear. Nick wouldn't see Diane with her kids. They were non-entities to him. If he showed up at her house and they weren't away somewhere with a sitter, he would leave. Yet Diane wanted to be with him, not just for fleeting encounters, but long-term. She talked of marriage and a future. She drew up plans for a home she wanted the couple to build. She did include bedrooms for the kids in those plans, but she put them on the opposite side of the house so that Nick wouldn't have to see them, and she also had plans to ensure a nanny would take care of them full-time anyway. It was very much a flowers in the attic type situation. Diane fantasized about living her life with her children, at best minimized, and at worst, well, gone entirely. All for Nick. Early in the investigation, Nick had been cleared as a suspect, but he continued to talk with police and with Hughey because he feared that his wife might be in danger. He also began to tape his phone conversations with Diane. He told police that he had seen the .22 caliber gun in her car when she left Chandler to move to Oregon. Hughey, who had a lot of circumstantial evidence but nothing firmer, was still waiting to charge Diane with a crime. He knew he needed something solid to present to a jury. He thought they had it when police found a bullet fragment under the trailer she had previously owned. You know, the one she had fired into the floor to scare Steve into thinking she had shot herself. That bullet turned out to be a likely match, but was so badly corrupted as to be disputable in court. Hughey doubled his efforts to find the gun. He also continued to quietly work with Dr. Wilhite and others to earn the trust of the one person who could sink Diane for good, her daughter, Christy. Diane, fully aware of this, worked on Christy too. Although the state had gone through the necessary steps to remove the children from her custody and had obtained a court order to prevent her from getting in touch with them, she convinced their father, Steve, to give her access when the children were with him. She was the one that told Christy that she was a suspect. She was the one who kept telling Christy about how that man in the middle of the road had hurt her. She was the one who told Christy not to tell. Months had passed and Christy was slowly regaining her speech, but still seemed reluctant to implicate her mother. Christy would occasionally be asked to refer back to that night. Her answers would be evasive. She'd say things like, "Mom loves me," in response. When asked to draw a picture of her assailant, Christy drew a figure that had no face. The psychologist working with her even asked, very early on, if she would write down the name of the person who shot her and her siblings. She would fold up the paper it was written on, put it in an envelope, and seal it, and no one would look. The psychologist promised that part. It would stay a secret. But writing it down might help Christy feel better. So Christy did. And the psychologist kept the promise. No one opened the envelope. Hughie visited often. He wanted Christy to be comfortable with him so that, should she ever testify, she would trust him. He could wait. Later that summer, John Inman called Hughie to say he might have some information about the case. Seems he had been driving on Old Mohawk Road that night of the shooting. It was around 11 p.m., he said, when he got behind a red Nissan with Arizona plates traveling very slowly toward town. Because of the curviness of the road, he had to remain behind the car for a few minutes before he could safely pass. He said he heard no screaming from the car and sensed no urgency on the part of the driver. He didn't see the driver because it was so dark, but he saw no indication that anyone needed help. This was promising, thought Hughie. Another, albeit odd, hole in Diane's story. Then, crime scene analysts came back with reconstruction scenarios for the crime. Blood spatter and bullet trajectories inside and outside the car did not match Diane's story of how the night unfolded. Then, 9 months after she'd been shot, Christy was ready to tell what she knew. And Hughie was ready to go to trial. Diane fell back on her usual strategy. She got pregnant again.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Diane Down's latest pregnancy happened the old-fashioned way. She had picked out a suitable candidate and began to pursue him. She never had trouble getting men into bed. She would tell anyone who would listen that she loved children. And by now, hardly anyone wasn't listening. Reporters with the New York Times and the Washington Post surely were. So was the nightly news. In fact, it seemed the whole world was listening. She went on and on about how children made her feel loved and worthwhile. Those listening closely noticed that not once did she mention that she loved them in return. Her pregnancy, however, was complicating Hughie's plans. He was originally going to wait until she gave birth to go to trial, but as she had been known to be particularly hardy in that category, Judge Gregory Foote of the Lane County Circuit Court in Oregon said they would proceed. So it was that Diane was at almost full term when Christy took the stand and recounted for the jury what happened that night. The mood in the courtroom shifted as the little girl, quite bravely, sat and faced her mother. Slowly but firmly, Hughie led Christy through a long series of questions that made it clear she remembered how her mother had gotten out of the car, gone to the trunk to retrieve something, and returned with a gun. She said only Danny was asleep, not all the children, as Diane had claimed, and it wasn't Rio playing. They had been listening to Duran Duran's Hungry Like the Wolf when Diane shot them. Hughie asked that the song be played so jurors might understand the context. Here's Ann Bradley reporting that day.
Christy Downs testified last week that a rock and roll song, Hungry Like a Wolf, played as her mother shot each one of them last May 19th. Today, jurors heard that song. The din of the music thumped through the courtroom. Elizabeth Diane Downs mouthed the song's words, I'm on the hunt, I'm after you, and moved her head and hands, enjoying the beat of the music. Jurors didn't take their eyes off of Downs. Some appeared stunned by her reaction to the song.
When the psychologist was called, Hughie asked her to open the still-sealed envelope to read the piece of paper on which Christy had written the name of her assailant. It read, Mom. More people testified. Crime scene reconstructionists, Diane's husband Steve, Diane's parents, Robert Knickerbocker. Diane even got on the stand to mount her own defense. On the stand, she said that Christy was mistaken about the Duran Duran song because, quote, when the keys are out of the ignition, the tape player's off, end quote. When asked about her behavior when the song was played in the courtroom, she said, quote, that tape has no bad connotations. That tape was Cheryl's favorite tape. It can't make me feel bad. Sorry. I was just being me, end quote. Diane thought her own testimony went well. But there were a lot of questions she couldn't answer, like why she had placed a carefully folded towel on her own wound, thus explaining no blood inside the driver's seat area, while her children were actively bleeding out in the car, or why she claimed she had driven 100 miles per hour when a witness testified it was more like 10, or why she had wanted Dr. Wilhite to pull the plug on a child he had just saved. When the verdict was read on June 17, 1984, Diane's pregnancy was full term. She was sentenced to life in prison, plus 50 years. 10 days after the verdict was read, she gave birth to a daughter. The publicly unnamed father relinquished all custody. The baby was put up for adoption. 3 years later, Diane was in the news again when she escaped from the Oregon Women's Correctional Center in Salem, where she had been serving her time. A KATU-TV reporter filed this report.
Convicted murderer Diane Downs left behind her ripped blouse, evidence of her struggle to break out of the maximum security facility. Prison officials say Downs walked into the unsupervised prison recreation yard early this morning. Apparently, she scaled this 18-foot fence, maneuvered her way over the rolls of razor ribbon, and jumped to freedom, but not before triggering a perimeter alarm system.
Over the next 10 days, Oregon State Police staged a 14-state manhunt looking for her. They contacted her parents, placed guards at the home of her children's adoptive parents, and scoured all her old haunts. 10 days later, she was recaptured at the home of Wayne Seifer, an ex-husband of a fellow inmate. She was found in bed with him. When Oprah Winfrey asked where she'd been going, she said she was headed to California to clear her name. In reality, she was found less than a mile from the prison. She had made a beeline to Seifer, who said that when he had answered the door, she said she had just been let out of prison. He described her as, quote, a girl with no clothes on, end quote. Psychiatrists again delved into her psyche. This time, she was diagnosed as having an antisocial personality and was likely a, quote, deviant sociopath, end quote. As a result of the escape attempt, she had time added to her original sentence and was moved first to the New Jersey Department of Corrections Clinton facility, then to the Central California Women's facility in Chowchilla. Each had better security. Diane has continued to claim her innocence. She has even said that she knows there were 30 witnesses out there on Old Mohawk Road that night who could support her version of events. If they exist, none has spoken up. Both Christy and Danny were adopted by Prosecutor Hughie and his wife. That's right, the man who put Diane Downs behind bars adopted her two surviving children in 1986. This was a big news story when it was revealed. The ethical ramifications are wild. When KEZI reporter John Doyle asked her about it, Diane said,
I'm concerned that after seeing and being through what Hughie's put me through for the past 3.5 years, I'm concerned that even if Hughie found out what really happened, he would bury it and not let anybody know what happened. I sometimes wonder if maybe that's why he adopted the kids, so that the story can never come out. Whereas if she was living in another home, those people, if they found out what happened, might tell.
To this day, people who want to believe Diane Downs is innocent cite Hughie's adoption of the children as proof the conviction was corrupt, which is exactly why this kind of thing typically never happens. But to give the flip side, the kids were in bad medical shape. Christie's injuries, including the stroke, left her with ongoing medical and psychological needs. Danny was paralyzed from the waist down. They had been in foster care since the shooting because their father Steve, for some reason, wasn't interested in taking them in. So what some people see as fishy behavior, plenty of others see as simply an amazing deed. The other child Diane gave birth to just after her conviction in 1984 did not know her own origin story until she was 11. Rebecca Babcock had always known she was adopted, but her parents had kept the details purposely vague to protect her. But Rebecca, who had been raised in Bend, Oregon, wanted to know. So she tricked her babysitter into divulging the specifics. By the way, the babysitter knew because of fears immediately following Downs' prison escape. Rebecca then went to Barnes & Noble and found Ann Rule's book on her mother's case. She opened it to the pages that contained photographs.
I opened it and looked at a picture of Diane Downs sitting at a table. It was a face to what I had been looking for, and it wasn't a face that I wanted to see. The cold look in her eyes scared me, and seeing her hands that, you know, were just like mine, the reality set in that that's who gave birth to me. And it was scary. I slammed the book shut and I left. I shut it out. I didn't want to think about it anymore.
Later, Becky would discover that people were fascinated by her link to the child killer. That led Becky to fear she was like her mother. She would tell ABC News' Elizabeth Vargas that the whole thing broke her. She fell into drugs and dangerous behavior for a while, but has since rebounded and is now, as an adult, a behavioral health coordinator. She did reach out to Christie and Danny, who, she says, declined her invitation to meet. Diane has been turned down three times for parole, with Lane County District Attorney Douglas Harkleroad telling the parole board that she has, quote, demonstrated no insight into her criminal behavior, end quote. She still can be found in the news. Late in 2024, she filed a petition for post-conviction relief because of a recent Oregon Supreme Court ruling that deemed non-unanimous jury verdicts unconstitutional. And while the jury in her case ruled unanimously that Cheryl had been murdered by her mother, the two attempted murder convictions were based on 10-2 jury votes. Now 70 years old, she is seeking a new trial. In 1989, a TV miniseries based on Rule's book earned Farrah Fawcett an Emmy nomination. She played Diane Downs. When asked how she prepared, Fawcett, then the mother of a 4-year-old, said that she instinctively gauged what her own reaction to such tragic events would be, and then she did the opposite. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Ann Rule's Small Sacrifices and James Sond and Elizabeth Bum Miller's profile, The Mother, in the Washington Post. She watched the 2010 ABC News documentary on the case. She read about the escape in local Oregon papers and watched a lot of local TV news coverage of the case that can now be found online. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod, and you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.